This is Audible.
Principles of Likeability. Skills for a memorable first impression, captivating presence, and instant friendships. Written by Patrick King. Read for you by Steve Campbell. Introduction. One of my friends, Yuval, came to me with a curious complaint a couple of years ago. He had recently moved to a new city and was having trouble making friends. I told him to give it some time, but he reminded me that it had been over a year, and he still had made no progress. So I started to suspect he was doing something wrong. I had known him since we were toddlers, so it was hard for me to say what it could be. After all, when you're a toddler, you don't necessarily stroll to the sandbox with the intention of making lifelong friends. More likely, we met in the sandbox and fought for the same toy truck, then ended up spending time together because of our constant clashes. The point is, I had no context for how Yuval was making friends or making himself likable to others. Naturally, I asked him what steps he was taking to create a new social circle. He told me he was meeting people all the time, but no one ever seemed to invite him out. His coworkers did only seldomly, and people he had met at hobby groups, group events, or from his frisbee golf team didn't seem to either. From this one answer, I knew what his problem was. He was putting the burden of taking initiative on everyone else but him. He made the mistake of assuming that since no one was actively making an effort to include him, he wasn't welcome. He was disempowering himself by thinking that he needed to wait for others to make the first step and that he didn't have the power to initiate himself. He didn't understand that to make new friends, and especially to break into existing social circles, he was the one that needed to make the effort to reach out, follow up, invite, and plan. He needed to be the one showing up and making things happen because, frankly, most people are either too lazy or too passive to make new friends as often as they can. People fall into routines and find their small enclaves and don't often explore outside of them. So Yuval needed to generate enough momentum to either find people who were more open or break into those enclaves. Expecting anything else is like sitting at home in the dark and being surprised when you discover that you don't have a nice tan. Yuval adjusted his behavior. All it really required was initiating 3 more text conversations a week, and was able to find his own enclave in his new city soon enough. I didn't realize it at the time, but Yuval was the victim of the thought process that keeps many of us from new friends and easy likability. He decided to treat people like they weren't friends yet, which means he treated them like strangers. This meant some version of formality between a job interview and a professional networking event. Not very conducive to the impression most of us want to present to new friends. It turns out, making the small decision to be friends and skip the unnecessary progression of slowly warming up to people is a major key in how likable you are. Likeability is not rocket science. But there are specific principles I've found through my own experience, my years coaching, and my hawk-like observation of people that tip the scales. Thankfully, the principles I've described in this book aren't things you need to be born with. They are behaviors you can cultivate and grow. When people like you, they are happy to do favors for you and provide you with whatever you might need. They show you brand new opportunities and open doors for your success. As social animals, humans crave companionship and friendship, and you'll never be lacking in that. The world is not a meritocracy, unfortunately, and likability is an everyday superpower that can grant you the keys to any situation. Chapter 1. The Principles of Deciding to Be Friends. Charlie is a standoffish guy. He doesn't like to talk to people he doesn't know. When he's introduced to Michael, he keeps his usual cold distance. This makes Michael think that Charlie doesn't like him. Michael doesn't count Charlie as a friend and avoids him since being around Charlie makes him feel disliked and uncomfortable. Meanwhile, Charlie actually desperately wants to become friends with Michael and wonders why Michael doesn't see his continued interaction as a sign of interest. Let's imagine if Charlie took a different approach to strangers and even acquaintances. What if when he met Michael, he decided to be warm and make the conscious decision to become friends with Michael? Off the bat, he considers Michael a close friend. He would be beyond shallow small talk and genuinely care about what is going on in his life. His efforts would pay off because they make Michael open up and feel engaged. Michael starts to talk to Charlie, and they find things in common that help them establish a good friendship. Initially, Charlie didn't think of Michael as a friend, and it became a reality. Charlie's mindset made him treat Michael as a stranger, and Michael reciprocated within the tone that was set. But thinking of Michael as a friend made Charlie treat him as such. This seems like such an easy choice to make, but this isn't how we are conditioned to think about people. Make the conscious decision. We're conditioned to think about people from a linear perspective. Introduce self, sniff them out, determine their worth, then slowly invest in building a relationship. But that's wrong for so many reasons. This creates the very mindset that keeps you from being likable and making friends. It creates a path of hoops for people to jump through. What happens when we follow the linear path and treat people like a stranger? People erect walls around strangers. They have been taught to do this to protect themselves, since you can never know what another person's intentions are if you are too blindly trusting. The coldness and distance you put out will drive the other person away, preventing friendship from budding. Simply realizing that you are acting in two completely different ways should allow you to see the better decision to make. The decision to treat people as friends instantly. Someone has to take the first step, and it might as well be you. It's a matter of small shifts in thought. For instance, the difference between saying, "We're friends," or "We're not friends yet." Your behavior towards someone adjusts as you adopt one of these attitudes. If you say, "We're friends," warmth is immediately established, and you let your guard down and don't converse as if you're in a job interview. When you say, "We're not friends yet," you keep people at arm's length. This distance is chilly and can be off-putting to another person. You feel like something needs to happen, a sign of some sort, for you to relax and be yourself. You are reserved and bite your tongue and generally don't reveal your real personality. For example, when you meet a new neighbor, you can go one of two ways. You can treat him as a stranger and get to know him gradually through a series of boring conversations over weeks. Your neighbor sees no reason to like you or engage with you, so he doesn't. Or you could go the other way and make the decision to act like old friends. Ignore conventional barriers and invite him into your life. Now you two are buddies, and he's more than willing to watch your house when you are gone and feed your elderly cats. How you choose to regard this neighbor dictates your behavior and hence dictates your future relationship and interactions. Think about the way you physically regard your friends. Friends are not distant in any way, shape, or form. They will touch each other and hug goodbye. They will violate the strict physical and mental distance boundaries that people naturally erect in the face of something unfamiliar. Again, consider the body language and background tension that will linger over a job interview, or simply even two strangers having lunch. But if you observe a meal between two friends, you'll see people with their guard down, touching, violating space, and probably violating each other's privacy repeatedly. They joke around and bring up personal details that they know about each other. Their body language is more relaxed, and they incline toward each other to express their emotional connection. Topics like the weather or other banal things are not necessarily between friends. These boring topics are simply silence fillers for strangers to use to avoid talking about emotions. When you make the decision to be friends with someone you haven't met yet, you are also making the decision to be comfortable with them. There was a study conducted among Italian adults regarding swearing and likability. Using more informal speech and swear words in political blog posts made voters form better impressions of the political candidates writing the posts. A related study discovered that people found political candidates more relatable and persuasive when they used the word damn in a speech about college tuition, as opposed to candidates who avoided using the word. In a 2017 paper, workers located in the United Kingdom, France, and the United States used swear words to either get attention or convey urgency, which in turn led to solidarity and friendships. In the workplace, women who swore earned more respect from their male colleagues in male-dominated offices. Yet another study concluded that co-workers who swore more were closer to those they chose to swear around, presumably because of exactly what we've been referencing in this chapter. Friendship leads to lower guard and authentic conversation. Finally, a study of Swedish co-workers investigated how they use swearing to convey familiarity and affection to one another. The most popular colleague in the study, an older man named Igor, would reiterate what people said to him, but would insert the word damn, saying things like, "Exactly, that is damn difficult." Based on these studies, you get a clearer picture of the value of treating people as friends. It allows both parties to let loose and be comfortable without the specter of judgment hanging over their heads. If you take the first step, people will relax and understand that you are someone that they can also relax around. Of course, this also means that the number of conversations you will have about the weather, commuting, and weekend plans will shrink. But that's a good sign that you are discussing realer topics. Friends talk about personal matters, negative or positive. A study at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, the California Graduate School of Family Psychology, the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the Arizona State University showed the power of getting deep and personal. College students were split into pairs and told to spend 45 minutes getting to know each other. They were given questions to ask each other, only some of the students were told to ask increasingly personal questions. One example of such a question was, "What was your relationship with your mother?" Other students only had banal small talk questions like, "How was the weather today?" or, "What is your favorite holiday?" The group who discussed the personal questions reported feeling closer to the other student at the end of the study. Personal details facilitate friendship because that's what friends talk about. It seems circuitous, but the point is that you should even talk about personal things that you would normally shy away from with strangers. Admittedly, we also don't do this because it's scary. You are quite literally putting yourself out to be rejected and judged when you make such ventures to strangers and acquaintances. This is valid, but the psychological principle known as reciprocity will prevent this the vast majority of the time. Reciprocity is where someone tends to pay back and return what they get from you, whether it's positive or negative. For example, if someone buys you lunch, you will feel indebted to them and return their gesture by buying them something or treating them better in some way. In this instance, if you've given them such positive energy and openness, people will most likely return it in kind. Psychologically speaking, you don't have much to fear in terms of judgment and rejection. However, this goes even further with reciprocity of liking, another psychological phenomenon that governs our actions. This means that if someone thinks you like him, he is more likely to like you. Since he knows that you like him, he knows that you won't reject him. He also knows that you find something attractive about him, on a friendly level at least, which boosts his ego. You make him feel good, so he wants to be around you. He views you as a friendly face and an ally in life if you like him. So when you express friendship to people and make them think that you like them, there are at least two psychological drives that cause us to be accepted and not rejected. A 1959 study, published in Human Relations, found that participants were told that certain members of a group discussion would like them. All of the group members were chosen randomly and did not know each other. The researchers had no idea if they would like each other or not. But after disclosing this, they found that the participants best liked the people in the group, They were told supposedly like them back. More recently, researchers at the University of Waterloo and the University of Manitoba found that when we expect people to accept us, we act warmer towards them. Our warmer behavior makes it more likely that they will like us as a result. So if you don't know how someone feels about you, act like you like them, and they will most likely like you back. Again, it's circuitous and reminiscent of questioning whether the chicken or the egg came first. But it's clear that someone has to act first. So take that role. The takeaway is that you must decide that someone is your friend, not a stranger, and doing so will make you far more likable. Speak more comfortably, relax your body, lean towards them as they talk, and avoid boring topics with no emotional connection, such as the weather. Try to learn about them and find out what you two might have in common. The alternative is a boring conversation that you probably don't want to be a part of. Show up. Part of making the decision to be friends is making the decision to proactively spend time with people. Friends spend time with friends. Thus, you can't expect a friendship to blossom if you only see them once a month. You need to accept reality and adjust your expectations to match reality. The more face time you spend around someone, the more opportunities you have to expand your initial efforts at building rapport and closeness. After all, exposure to someone's face breeds the familiarity and comfort that can make people like you, as many studies have shown. Woody Allen once stated that 80% of success is showing up. Being present gives you the chance you need to make an impression and forge a close relationship. When you have an opportunity to be around people, take it. Go to parties, stop by a person's desk at work, or go over to someone's house. While social media is a great tool for connecting with people, it does not replace face-to-face interaction. You can use Twitter or Facebook to connect with people and make plans, but be sure it all leads you to being physically present. Actually make the effort and notice the rewards that you reap as a result. Mere exposure theory is the name of the principle behind this. Mere exposure theory is the phenomenon that people like you the more they see you. People who dislike you will even start to like you more if they are exposed to you enough. While this principle can work with any stimulus, from places to things to products, it works especially well with people. You can think of it as a likability and friendship through a passive process, such as osmosis. Think about when you start a new job. On the first day, some people may rub you the wrong way. They may make poor impressions. You make up your mind that you dislike some of the people in the new workplace. As time passes, however, you start to get used to these people, and you even start to befriend them. This is because you see them literally every day, and you get used to them. As you become more frequently exposed to people and learn more about them, you start to accept them and even like them. To be likable, you should maximize the amount of exposures you have with people. The more you see each other, the more you like each other. At some point, however, the linear relationship between exposure and liking starts to wane. This is when you want to think about spending time with people in the form of a simple formula. Frequency plus intensity. You can add more and more intensity to the relationship over time as you speak more profoundly about emotions, fulfill each other's needs, support each other, bond over things in common, and learn how to rely on each other. Suppose you spend time with someone twice a week and always have deep, moving conversations about your differing worldviews. That sounds like a pretty close friend. Be the initiator. Given what we've learned about the importance of simply spending time with people, it's important to understand that you must create those opportunities for yourself. Just like with taking the first step to deciding to be friends, you can't expect other people to create opportunities for you to be more likable. Very few of us are so proactive, and they might even be just as shy and distant around strangers as you are. You have to make the effort and put yourself out there first. Maybe this feels unfair, but it's just how life works. In fact, this is a major sticking point many will have. But imagine Yuval's position as being new in the city and striving to break into existing social circles. It's only natural that he has to be the one making the effort, because the other people involved are all comfortable and settled already. Most people want to make new friends, but lack the courage and willpower to make the first move. They're comfortable with their current friends, or have trouble adjusting to the idea that they need to actively welcome people into their lives. They may be afraid of bothering you, or of not coming up with something fun to do that you would be interested in joining them in. Finally, they might fear rejection and looking and feeling stupid if you reject the friendship. This is why being new or meeting a new crowd for the first time can make you feel left out. But this hardly means that the whole world is rejecting you. It's easy to think, if no one invites me out, they must not like me. But maybe they are waiting for you to call them, and you are waiting for them to call you. As a result, no one calls anyone. The truth is, everyone is just waiting for others to initiate social connections, not realizing that they should take the first step. To become more likable, you need to set aside your own shyness and unwillingness to leave your comfort zone. You must make the first move and attempt to get to know people by asking them to do things with you. If you wait around for others to do this for you, you will be bitterly disappointed. And recall that with the principle of reciprocity of liking, just indicating interest in someone will make them feel more strongly towards you. Think about how much courage it takes to initiate a friendship. Some people just can't drum up that courage, but since you can continue initiating until your friendship becomes something where you both feel comfortable initiating. Don't overanalyze it when someone fails to initiate. You will hear yes far more often than no. But you will only hear yes if you actually try to make the effort. There are some specific ways to initiate more effectively. Have a specific plan in place. Being too vague can really make people uncomfortable. You don't ask, "Do you want to hang out sometime?" That's too open and still calls for the other person to initiate, so what was the point exactly? People are lazy and most likely won't follow up other than by agreeing. It also puts them on alert because they don't know what they're potentially agreeing to. Rather, you should step forward with a specific plan in place. For example, you might say to someone, "Let's hang out," and it will probably never happen because it's so open-ended. But if you say, "I'm having a cookout tonight with 4 or 5 of my friends. Want to come by?" That is more specific, and the person is more likely to show up. The other person has some guidance and direction, and thus feels more comfortable accepting the invitation and actually appearing. You helped them set their expectations for the interaction and prepare. Additionally, you want to make plans that are attractive to the other person. Find a common activity you both love, then propose that you both go do it. People will be more open to spending time with you if you propose an activity that they will enjoy at least, so they will have some baseline incentive to go. Keep it simple, specific, and attractive. The same goes for ease. Make plans easy for them to attend in terms of commitment, cost, and physical location. All you're doing is increasing your chances that your initiation pays off and you don't initiate something that was only going to be rejected. Do the first activities as a group. Sometimes, one-on-one time can be awkward. It can also make it seem like you're trying to get romantic, and others might not be as open to leaving their comfort zone. To get around this, you can propose that you go out with other people and do something as a group. If they ask you who else is coming, you can float some names and ask them, "Who else do you think we should invite?" This creates teamwork ethic, where you are both involved in the planning. This is mostly for the benefit of the other person, to increase their level of comfort and ability to open up. Just as big group settings sound daunting to some, small intimate settings sound intimidating to others. Get comfortable going out alone. If no one takes you up on your offer and you have no group to go out with, don't feel bad about going by yourself to whatever the intended activity was. Sure, you don't want to be the only single person there, but going alone accomplishes at least one of two things. First, it can help you with future conversations with these folks. They may ask you, "How was that movie?" You will lose a conversation opportunity if you just reply, "I didn't go." You can also initiate again by adding, "Next time you should definitely come." The other benefit is that you appear less desperate and more confident if you aren't depending on others to have a good time. People will admire that you still went without them. If you are comfortable being alone in real-world settings, people will be drawn to you because you appear happy and confident. In addition, if you attend an event solo, you are far more likely to meet new people. If you attend an event with one or two other people, it's par for the course to cluster together the entire time and not meet anyone new. Say you go to a Comic-Con. People tend to like those who they share things in common with, so you can bond with people at these events over shared interests. If you are just hanging out by yourself at home, you will never meet anybody new. After all, who will come knocking on your door randomly hoping to get to know you? Join a group. The best way to meet people is to put yourself out there, as we already discussed. But the easiest way to do this is to join some type of group or start a group. In the modern world of social media, finding groups and inviting people you don't even know to go out is easier than ever. You can easily assemble a group or find one. There's a great mobile phone app called Meetup, where people with common interests interact and form groups that go out to do things. Finding fun things to do and meeting people with shared interests is incredibly easy with this app. You can also check out Facebook groups for the same purpose. Overall, instead of getting together and talking about what happened in the past, do something new together so you subsequently will have something to talk about after. People bond over shared experiences and memories, so make memories with people, even those you barely know. This applies to old friendships as well. Yes, you have to initiate and keep working at old friendships too. They can decay with time and boredom if no one makes an effort, and often you will be the one who has to make the effort if you want to see any change. Remember, no one is obligated to make the first move, and most people won't anyway because it's too hard. So to see results, you must make the effort yourself. Takeaways. A highly underrated facet of being likable is the simple decision to treat people like friends instead of strangers. It sounds small, but it affects everything you say or do toward people. This chapter is about making that conscious choice and realizing that you aren't doing it. When you make the decision, you might also realize how passive you generally are in regards to seeking out new people. This might be because of fear of judgment and rejection. But rejection and judgment are far away due to reciprocity and reciprocity of liking. The mere exposure effect also helps, as there is a clear linear relationship between time spent with someone and overall affection for them. Therefore, we must usually be the first person to spring into action, because others aren't conditioned to, which leads to a stalemate of each party waiting for the other to act first. You have to take initiative and be the initiator and planner, at least at first. Be specific with your plan, make it easy for them, and be comfortable going out without others. Chapter 2. The Principle of Self-Disclosure. Sharon is the type of person who overshares. Her family and friends hate this and tell her not to do it, but she does it anyway as it's part of who she is. As a result, Sharon will strike up a conversation with literally anyone, and will talk about anything. Her sex life, her childhood, her relationship with her mom, her likes and dislikes, and her political views. She has a huge diversity of friends from all over who enjoy talking to her. They know a lot about her, but she also knows a lot about them. Her ability to throw modesty to the wind and talk freely about herself attracts people to her. Ellen liked Sharon for this very reason, yet Ellen hates self-disclosure and tries to get Sharon to stop it. When Ellen meets new people, she doesn't share much about herself and refuses to disclose personal details about her life. It takes her a long time to open up to anyone. Therefore, she is mysterious and people don't know how to read her. They tend to like her well enough because she comes across as nice and harmless, but they don't get close to her because they see no reason to. She has far fewer friends than Sharon does. Perhaps if she were more like Sharon and more open about herself, she might have better luck pulling in new friends. Sharing more about yourself can make others like you more. The principle of self-disclosure involves disclosing information about yourself to make people more interested and emotionally invested in you. It can also make people feel closer to you and more open to sharing things about themselves in exchange. Sharing things about yourself works because it makes you become a real three-dimensional human that they can relate to and feel familiar with. When you self-disclose, others will too, and that's where you really start to break through barriers. The problem is most of us don't do this off the bat. Like in the first principle, you must make the first move and start disclosing things about yourself to encourage the other person to do so. Sadly, the responsibility to initiate likability, again, falls on you. Sharing more. Now you may wonder what to share. What kind of information should you impart? What information is TMI? Too much information. And hence will make people not like you. What information is beneficial to share with others and enhances your likability? What should you keep private? Generally, the more you disclose, the better. TMI is beneficial for your likability because, again, this is how friends relate. Friends are notorious for oversharing without shame or inhibition. They may laugh, gag, or declare, "I didn't need to know that," but they still share everything. So even if you feel that you are entering TMI territory, that is still better than not disclosing anything, because you are still treating others like your friends. This ties into the first principle that we've already discovered and allows you to kill two birds with one stone. By undersharing, you present a version of yourself who is afraid to make any waves and is ultimately very forgettable. Share what is on your mind. TMI might include details of your sex life or your controversial opinions. In polite conversation with strangers, these details are not appropriate, but friends love to cross polite boundaries. So to put both this principle and the first one into play, overshare on things you normally would not share with strangers to gain more leverage and likability with others. Share slowly at first to gauge people's responses, but once you get the sense that someone is on the same page and willing to befriend you as well, you can open the floodgates, so to speak. The more you reveal about yourself, the more connection points you generate with the other person. You reveal things you like or dislike, which the other person may be able to relate to and disagree or agree with. You can find more things in common as you reveal your preferences, opinions, loves, hates, likes, dislikes, sensitivities, memories, emotions, thoughts, and anecdotes. For example, say you're at a party and meeting with people you have never seen before. Usually this situation is daunting, and you feel awkward and clam up with a drink in your hand to prevent your fragile ego from rejection by these new people. But using the tips in this book, you disclose a lot about yourself, and you talk about how much you like fishing, anime, and knitting, all three of your seemingly unrelated hobbies. You have stories about each of these that you can launch into from normal small talk questions. They speak to your interests, how you react to situations, and your personality in general. Everyone in the room who loves one of those three things, or can simply relate to how you might react to a situation, can now connect with you, and a conversation is born based on the topic you two share. All you need to do is answer questions with a series of details about yourself or tell a story about yourself. Think about it this way. Provide three details where you would have replied with a one-word answer, or provide three sentences where you would have replied with one sentence. That's the basic type of step that is needed for self-disclosure to work its wonders. If you had a boring weekend, still name three details so people aren't left with nothing to work with. It might feel extraneous at first, but it might also let you realize how little you disclose about yourself to others. Share your emotions. The reason emotions are so powerful is because they are universal. Everyone in the world, from Americans to Aboriginals to African bush people, share similar emotions, emotional responses, and even facial expressions. Scientific studies have shown that people from different cultures can recognize what smiles and frowns mean, which indicate that all people feel and express emotions in similar ways. So expressing your emotions and making them known to others is a foolproof method to get others to feel close to you. You become more human and relatable when you express your emotions. Others feel more comfortable expressing their own emotions and agreeing or disagreeing with how you feel once you dare to be open about your emotions. Again, this starts with talking about how happy or sad something makes you. That's all it takes to open a deeper dialogue. Share stories from your own life. Again, this makes you seem more real and three-dimensional. Even though it doesn't feel like it, we all go through similar circumstances and struggles every day. We all brush our teeth, hate waking up, and commute to some kind of job. You have some part of your life story that others can relate to. This makes people feel closer to you and lets them laugh and talk about how they went through the same thing. Often, they will start to tell their stories based on yours. We all have common experiences. We all remember when we learned to ride a bike, embarrassing moments in high school, or disasters in dating. Share your story with gusto. Make it seem more engaging and entertaining. Finally, give people room to interject with their own stories so that they can feel as if they are participating and relating to you. You won't be as likable if you hog the spotlight and never let others talk. The purpose of sharing is to encourage mutual sharing, so don't keep things focused on you. Ultimately, you want to just get into the habit of talking about yourself more and sharing things you wouldn't necessarily think about sharing right now. You can work on even just thinking out loud more. You seem more real to others, and you ensure that others can relate to you. You create more conversations out of thin air. It can be intimidating. You have been taught your whole life to be modest and even private. Now you're going against years of teachings. You may worry that you are bothering others or overstepping boundaries. But the thing is, you'll find that people actually love it when you talk about yourself more and become more open. You'll have an easier time capturing others' attention, forming bonds, and even having fun with others just because you talk about yourself more. No judging. If you are still on the fence about opening up about yourself, here are some scientific studies that support the veracity of this. A 1989 study by Hilton and Fine set out to determine the cause of people's judgments, assumptions, and stereotyping. What made the brain immediately assign traits and a veritable backstory to some people versus others? Why were some people so quick to jump to conclusions? It was found that the less information people had about a certain subject or person, the more they began to fill in the gaps with information that was stereotypical of a general representation. If I describe someone who belonged to a country club, drove an expensive car, played tennis, and liked lacrosse, there's a very specific image you might conjure up. To prevent stereotyping and being instantly judged, Hilton and Fine found that simply providing details about the subject, completely unrelated to the stereotype in mind, diluted the stereotype and made people more likely to trust and like others. The more detail about the person, the better, even if it was completely random. When we have limited information, we assume a person is just the same as the most stereotypical representation that has those traits. When we have more information about someone in any regard, we realize we can't define them by those one or two traits, and we cease stereotyping and judging. You can make people like you more, stereotype you less, and emotionally invest in you more by providing seemingly useless and nonsensical details about your life. People like to make fun of TMI, but the reality is that TMI can ultimately make you more likable. Of course, preferably you share positive or at least neutral information about yourself. You become less of a threat and more of a known quantity. People become less suspicious of you and are more willing to give you the benefit of the doubt. By sharing seemingly trivial information about yourself, you allow people to feel like they know you, and they stop making assumptions. And again, it doesn't even matter if the details are relevant to your identity, career, non-threatening nature, or life. You can share your preference of glasses brand, your favorite color, and perhaps where you went to school. The more information about you that is out there, the less readily people can judge and stereotype you, simply because you won't fit those stereotypes and assumptions anymore. For example, what if we learned that the person who plays tennis and belongs to a country club was poor growing up and went to college on a tennis scholarship? Also, they drive a 20-year-old car and prefer to eat burritos. Does that change your view of them? We certainly wouldn't stereotype and make more assumptions about them than we previously did. In fact, the additional information we've learned blows the doors off any category we could put them into. And in a sense, that's the goal, to make it possible for us to fit into any broad category or generalization. People are only judging you based on what they aren't seeing of you. With more information, people suddenly become three-dimensional and not the static character biographies we see in movies. We are humanized, and we eventually realize that all humans are complex amalgamations. We were never going to fit into a stereotype or box. In reality, you really haven't done anything profound. You haven't even given any information that's important or useful. Oversharing to maximize likability works to get people to feel that they know different sides of you. An easy way to share more details is to get into the habit of offering unsolicited information. For instance, if someone asks about your weekend, don't resort to answering, "Good, how about yours?" A guideline I like to use is to give four distinct details when answering easy questions. In this way, you will get into the habit of giving people more information, which will make conversation flow better anyway. Here's an example of zero sharing, little information, and a high likelihood of judgment and stereotyping. Where are you from? Oklahoma. You? If you don't know anything about a person besides the fact that they're from Oklahoma, where does your mind automatically go? It goes to whatever your stereotypes about Oklahoma are. You don't know if this person was born there, raised there, or only lived there for a couple of years. You don't have the context to make a good judgment about them, and yet you do anyway. This one trait defines them in your mind. Now, here's an example of why giving unsolicited information can be helpful. Where are you from? Oklahoma, but I was born in New York. My parents were originally from France, and I grew up visiting France very frequently. Also, I have 8 dogs. Now attempt to put this person into a box. It's the same person as before, but it's nearly impossible because there is so much information about them that you simply have to take them as they are. By knowing more about them, they have become more humanized and interesting. The added benefit to sharing unsolicited information, and more in general, is you make it extremely easy for others to connect with you. When you spout off details about your life, it's easy for them to find common ground and know you as a person. If you divulge personal information or intimate details of your life, You'll also be appearing to take the first steps to building trust and showing vulnerability to others. The more that's out there, the more there is for people to hook on to and relate to. In 1997, Arthur Aaron found that sharing did more than simply make you less susceptible to judgment from others. It creates emotional closeness and investment. In fact, the more intimate and invasive the information, the better. He split participants into two groups. One group questioned each other on 36 very specific and intimate questions, including personal vulnerabilities and insecurities. Sample questions were, "What is your most terrible memory?" and "What is your most treasured memory?" It's impossible not to get personal when faced with these questions. The other group was tasked to ask each other only shallow small talk questions about their everyday lives. It's not something people are comfortable doing, but the participants follow directions. We feel like we're offending people or showing too much of ourselves, which is frightening. But the participants who were tasked with asking each other sensitive and sometimes prying personal questions developed greater levels of trust, rapport, and mutual comfort with one another. They felt emotional closeness, even though they didn't know each other before the study. Here are some examples of the questions used. 1. Do you want to be famous? For what? This tells you what a person really values or imagines themselves to be skilled at. This can reveal someone's deepest desires and fantasies. 2. If you were able to live up to 90 and save either the mind or the body of a 30-year-old, which would you want to save? You learn whether someone values the physical or mental more. You also learn if someone is honest or not. 3. If you could change anything about how you were raised, what would you change? Here you gain deep insight into someone's past and history. You learn about his or her regrets and if his or her childhood was happy. You may learn some deeply personal secrets about someone. 4. If you could wake up tomorrow with any one quality, what would that quality be? This question enables you to learn what someone wants to be and what he or she values in a person. The person you are asking this question of will always answer with the quality that matters most to him or her. 5. Is there something that you have wanted to do for a long time? Why haven't you done it yet? People all have dreams. They also have regrets. Asking someone this lets you uncover what he or she dreams of or what he or she regrets not doing. It also makes him or her like you more because you are essentially goading this person to live his or her dream before it's too late. The other group, however, didn't develop this level of trust, confidence, and intimacy. They essentially remained at their initial level of emotional closeness. Aaron proved that when you share information, the receiving parties will like you more and feel closer to you and reciprocate. Finally, according to a study done by Theodore Newcomb, people tend to like those who are similar to them. The similarity attraction effect is where people are drawn to like people. Newcomb measured his subjects' views on things like sex and politics, then sorted them into a house to live together. The subjects who shared the same viewpoints were usually friendlier by the end of the study than those with dissimilar viewpoints. To compound the results of Newcomb's study, another study conducted by researchers at the University of Virginia and Washington University in St. Louis found that Air Force recruits tended to get along better with those who shared their negative personality traits rather than their positive ones. But here's the thing. You can only discover similarities when you self-disclose. So by sharing more about yourself, you can find things in common that make others like you more. Getting others to disclose. When you self-disclose, others will usually reciprocate, but sometimes they do not. In fact, some people are like talking to brick walls. How can you get others to self-disclose more consistently so it isn't one-sided sharing? There are some basic tried-and-true ways. You can ask questions such as, How do you feel about this weather? Instead of asking yes or no questions, as these will just get you monosyllabic answers. Instead, engage people by asking in-depth questions that provoke them to think and come up with a detailed response. There might seem to be little difference, but one version asks about emotions and can conjure up memories about the weather. Ask better questions and get better answers. You can also appeal to their interests. People love to chat about what they enjoy doing. Ask a person about his favorite hobbies and request that he teach you about it. Ask someone about his job as a flight attendant and how flying all of the time feels. You will get a person to open up if you try to talk about things that they care about or like. Everyone has a narrative to their life, stories that sum up how they ended up where they are. Ask about their stories, and they will be more than glad to document the twists and turns. Finally, you can stroke someone's ego. This will make him or her feel good and want to open up to get even more positive ego stroking. So you might tell a person, "I find your career fascinating. Tell me all about it." Or you might say, "You have the most gorgeous garden. How do you get your crocuses to bloom so late in the year?" Prompt them to speak by first building them up with a compliment. You can't control what others do, but you can choose to be the first to disclose. The law of reciprocation may just work for you. But is there a way to do this slightly more organically? There is a fancy term called elicitation. That makes it easier to get others to disclose. Elicitation is a type of questioning that uses a conversational style to disguise how you are sneakily obtaining information from someone. To use elicitation, you make a statement that plays on the other person's desire to respond for a variety of reasons. The other person will feel driven to respond in a certain way, even if they had no prior interest in engaging. The FBI came up with this term, and often use it in interrogation to get confessions or answers from people. A direct question may not always get a direct answer. Thus, it becomes important to phrase things differently to obtain information. Here is an example of how elicitation works as provided by the FBI. You are trying to plan a surprise party for someone, so you need to know his schedule, his friend's contact information, and his food and drink preferences. Of course, you can't ask him for this information directly, so how might you discover these pieces of information from him? You might make a presumptive statement. "I'm going to buy a grape soda. Do you want one?" This will seem like a random, harmless question, and he will correct you. "No, I prefer root beer." Now you know his drink preference. Then you can ask, "What time are you off work every night? My friend is looking for someone to help move." He will tell you his work schedule as a result. And so, you've gained valuable information without having directly asked for it. What's important is that elicitation is meant to break the dam and get people to start engaging and talking. There are various types of elicitation techniques according to researcher Ellen Naylor, and some of them are documented below. Recognition. People thrive when you recognize something good about them. Mention, "I love your sweater," and you will get a story about how the wearer obtained the sweater. Mention, "You were very thorough," and you will get a story about how the person went to military school and learned to be thorough at all times. They may have been tight-lipped before, but any chance to enhance praise is welcome. People have a natural desire to feel recognized and appreciated, so give them an opening to show off a little. You can also show appreciation to someone and compliment them. This is similar to recognition. People rarely turn down an opportunity to explain their accomplishments. Complaining. People love to complain, so you can get a person to commiserate with you by complaining first. If they don't commiserate, they might open up the other way by feeling compelled to defend what you are complaining about. Either way, you've opened them up and gotten some information out of them. You might tell someone at work, "I hate these long hours without overtime pay." And he will go into more detail about how he needs money from not being paid enough. This may lead him to disclose more about his home life and how many kids he has, and marital status issues he has related to finances. It may also lead to him disclosing how he deals with money problems. Either way, you have more information now. Key to this technique is creating a safe environment for people to brag, complain, or show other raw emotion. If you complain first, they feel that no negative topics are taboo, which creates a judgment-free zone. They don't feel like they will get into trouble with you. You don't have to complain to kickstart this. Just express your own negative emotions, vulnerabilities, or disappointments. People will figure, hey, if they talk about something so personal that casts them in a negative light, I guess I can talk about anything here. Correction. People love to be right. So if you say something wrong, they will gladly jump at the chance to correct you. This leads back to the earlier example about using presumptive statements to find out how to plan a surprise birthday party. If you give people an opportunity to flex their ego, most will seize it happily. An easy way to do this is to state something you know to be obviously incorrect to see if they will step in and break their silence. You can also state your assumptions about a person or situation and see if they agree or disagree. Yeah, I figured you for a vegetarian. You don't look like you like meat. Self-effacement. People have a tendency to play down their achievements and appear modest. Find out what someone is proud of and then ask him about it. He will downplay it with a blush. So then prompt him to tell you more or tell him that he obviously accomplished something huge and he will want to elaborate, either to further be modest or to brag a bit about his deeds. For example, ask him about his great golf victories if you notice golf trophies on his desk. Say, you must be a golf champion. And he will say no, then start to brag about his victories. Naivete. To be clear, this does not mean to act stupid. It means to act like you are on the cusp of understanding. Acting naive makes people feel compelled to teach, instruct, and show off their knowledge. People just can't resist enlightening you, especially if you're 95% of the way there and all people have to do is figuratively finish your sentence. I understand most of this theory, but there's just this one thing I'm unclear on. It could mean so many things. Shift the window. This is where you say something slightly outrageous that you know won't be answered, then pretend like you didn't bring it up. Why does this work? Does it even work? It's because you have put something out there to dramatically change the tone of the conversation, but then taken it back to not be addressed. Think of it as a cumulative effect. When you do this a couple of times, these are the types of questions people will engage with and answer, even if they were ice cold beforehand. You haven't actually committed a faux pas per se, but you've shifted the boundaries of the conversation. It's a good combination that can get people to lower their guards without them even realizing it, and eventually their window of what they feel is appropriate to be shared can be shifted and widened. Sometimes if you make your initial statement here outrageous and provocative enough, you might bait them into responding regardless. The more provocative, the better if you are really having trouble getting a peep from someone. Silence. Give people space to speak. When you take a step back, people will feel compelled to take a step forward and break the awkward tension. If you signal that you expect someone to speak and are waiting for them, they may open their mouths to meet your expectation. Takeaways. The principle of self-disclosure is a surprising one because it makes most people uncomfortable at first. But realizing that TMI is a powerful weapon in finding connection points with people can push most through the zone of discomfort. The truth is, sharing more about your emotions, life stories, and experiences will help you connect with people because they are universal. Plus, sharing more makes people judge and stereotype you less. When you disclose more, you are able to find similarities more easily with people. And similarity is a precursor to comfort, which is a precursor to likability. Of course, you want to share relatively slowly at first so you can gauge people's response. We know we should disclose more, and once we get into the habit, it's not that difficult. But what about compelling other people to reciprocate, which they may or may not always do? Sure, you can talk about their interests.